Some of the views expressed on the Mormon Channel are solely for the education and inspiration of our audience and may not represent the official position of the Church.
Enduring It Well is a program of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
In a moment, a life can change. All that was suddenly feels strangely different. Life isn't easy. It was never meant to be easy. It was meant to give us wisdom, even when life's lessons sometimes seem unbearable. Welcome to this week's edition of Enduring It Well, with host W.A. Christensen. It seems at times that our earthly journey is the only moment, the here, the now. We lived with our Heavenly Father before coming to this life. Our Father in Heaven knew there were lessons we could learn only by gaining a body of flesh and blood. It was to this end that He created this world and our opportunity to live here as mortals, gaining a most unique education called mortality. In order for the process to be of most benefit to us, a veil of forgetfulness was placed over us, requiring us to walk by faith. With the veil in place, we have forgotten who we really are and the true meaning of our mortal probation. There are those times when we catch glimpses of our true identity. Sometimes the fragile nature of our lives comes into full focus, if only briefly. In those slow-motion moments, we are reminded of what is really important, and life adjustments are often the results of such moments. What if you knew your time was limited? What if you felt you were seeing mortality for the last time, that your days, minutes, even seconds were numbered? Would you be ready to return to the God who gave you life, as Alma, the ancient American prophet, describes death? Are you ready to give a full accounting of your mortal experience? And what if, in that moment, you were given another chance, a second chance to meet the measure of your creation, to finish the work you were sent here to accomplish? How would you spend the additional or bonus time that remains? This is Enduring It Well, with host W.A. Christensen, sponsored by the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
On August 24, 2008, a single-engine Cessna prop plane left the airport in Aurora, Guatemala, en route to El Estor. On board was a group of American aid workers with Choice Humanitarian, a West Jordan, Utah-based group who had plans to build classrooms in Guatemala. Dan Lilienquist was one of 14 volunteers on board. Dan, a successful attorney and economist living in Bountiful, Utah with his wife Brooke and then five children, had just won his party's primary election for state Senate seat in the 23rd District in Utah. With all the demands of a CEO, a husband and father, and now the stress of an election, Dan sat back in his seat to relax for the hour flight on this humanitarian mission. Suddenly, the engine failed and the plane descended from 10,000 feet toward the jungle. The doomed plane crash-landed in a palm-lined field about 65 miles east of Guatemala City. Stunned, Dan struggled to focus his eyes and realized he had not perished. With the smell of fuel, the shooting pain in both legs, and the frightening new reality that one of his legs was on fire, Dan cried for help. Two Guatemalan farmers pulled Dan from the wreckage into safety. Lilienquist survived the crash, but 11 of the passengers, several who worked with Dan and were dear friends, did not. While in the hospital in Guatemala City, a nurse ran to the nearby Guatemala temple to get elders to come and give Dan a priesthood blessing. Once stable enough to transfer, Dan returned home to Utah to recover. In his recovery, he learned that he had won the state Senate election, would now be the newest senator from Davis County, Utah. Today, Dan remains in chronic pain, walks with a limp, and occasionally finds it difficult to sleep at night, all the result of the crash on that fateful day. Dan also carries with him a new perspective gained at the crash site in August of 2008, a realization of a second chance, an appreciation for loved ones, and a deep gratitude for the kindnesses of others. He also has a heightened sense of urgency to make a difference with his life. Welcome to Enduring It Well, Dan.
Thank you, Bill. Good to be with you.
Before we have you explain those new perspectives of both a second chance and urgency, let's go back to the crash. Describe for us, if you will, the feeling of descent, those thoughts that crossed your mind, in that moment of impact?
You know, it's different than you think. I've had a lot of time to think about this. We were there to build a school 45 minutes into a pretty peaceful flight. Our engine went out. And it went from the noise of the airplane, very loud, to a stillness that you never hear. And a sort, just a soft, you know, of the wind on the wings. And the first thought that went through my mind was, you're going to die. And then the second thought, it was really kind of a logical thought, you're going to die. And then the second thought was, that's okay. Everybody dies. And I looked through my life briefly. I mean, it wasn't like my life flashed before my eyes, but just one of those things where I felt like, you know, I felt like I'd done, I had lived appropriately. And I felt, you know, you go through, really, as people, you go through your covenants and you think, you know, am I worthy to hold a temple recommend? I knew at that time I was. And I felt like with my family in particular, I hadn't left things undone. Certainly felt like there was more I wanted to do. But in that moment, that's something I've reflected on a lot and grateful for, and really thought about covenants as something for us, maybe more than maybe the Heavenly Father needs. But after that, my thoughts went to my children. And one in particular, my wife and I, the previous Saturday, the day before, were late getting me to the airport. And my two-year-old Josh woke up as we were running out the door, and we had to take him with us. And we threw him in the back seat of our car, buckled him in. He didn't know what was going on at 6 in the morning. And I remember getting to the airport and rushing in, almost missing my flight, but I stopped and kissed him in that back seat. And that little boy's face came to mind, and that just knocked my breath out. And you know, that's what I thought about most of the way down.
So that reality of the fact that there may be this parting really hit you at that point.
Yeah, you know what hit me the most with that was the things I would miss with him. He was just learning how to talk. And just, you know, that age is just priceless. And
they're starting to become their own person.
And
now, you had other children.
Yeah, but he came to mind because he was so fresh, and I so enjoyed seeing him in that backseat. He was so excited, and I thought, here's what I'm going to miss. And I thought about my other children as well, and mourned my kids on the way down. And I was sitting close by with my friend John Carter, who passed away and had three kids, and I just know what was going through his mind too. And it was just a few minutes that we had.
Everyone knew this was a serious situation. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, you know, I'm positive everybody thought, okay, we're going to die, and 80% of us were right. I mean, 11 of 14 did die. But as you look out the window, we were over the jungle of Guatemala, no place to land, and fully loaded plane. It was different. People pictures, people screaming and things like that. It was very reverent, and people just in their own thoughts, and certainly it was with mine and with my family.
So now you were contemplating your own life, and you were saying it's okay. You've come to this conclusion that you're okay about dying. How did that feel?
It was almost like a quick examination. And then I didn't think about it. Like, okay, that's okay. And then my thoughts went to my children, and I didn't come back to it.
So was there ever a point during this descent that you now prepared for the physical side of it? Were you ready for did you brace yourself for the impact? What happened?
Well, you know, as we came down.
And how high were you?
We were about 10,000 feet. And as we came down, it took us about 4, maybe 5 minutes to descend. It was a long time. And as we came down, our pilot was banking left. And what kind of snapped me out of thinking about my family is we came 15 feet from hitting the side of this hill. And barely missed it, and came down and leveled out for for this last approach, and I couldn't see where we were going, but I could see trees everywhere. And what I did, and that kind of snapped me out of it, and I stopped mourning my kids, and that I just shifted into the moment, and I just said a quick prayer. Heavenly Father, I feel like there's more for me to do, but thy will be done. And I can't explain it except to say that for me, it was just something I did. I slid down in my seat and kind of laid out in the back of that plane.
Preparing for the impact.
Yeah, preparing for impact, sticking my legs forward and kind of grabbing onto a handhold at the side of the door of the plane. And
now, had you thought about doing that, or was it just instinctive?
I've asked myself that question 1,000 times. It didn't feel like an impression. But had I stayed where I was sitting, I would have died. And I couldn't have known. I didn't cross my mind that...
Wasn't time to really prepare in that.
No, it wasn't time. It was quick. And I finished my prayer, and I slid down on my seat. And the last thing I remember, well, two things, looking out the window and seeing the tops of the trees, and then looking forward one last time, and then everything went black. And what happened was we ended up hitting our left wing on a tree, and it flipped us into the ground on the roof of the plane. And my colleagues and friends who were sitting next to me were sitting high enough it killed them. And and I came to after being knocked out by the head trauma I took, and found myself with broken legs and dazed, and then from there everything kind of went south. So, you know, but that was the crash through the crash.
So that was down to the ground, and you have this sudden impact. What's that like in that moment? Is it quiet?
I was completely knocked out. And when I came to, the first thing I remember is falling forward onto my hands after unbuckling my seatbelt, and my hands fell into sunlight. And I still have that image in my mind of sunlight cutting across my arms and my hands. And I said, I'm alive. I'm alive. And I knew I was injured. And I looked down, and my left foot was still in my boot, and I could see the tread of my boot. It was, my foot was broken off and on my left foot, and my right leg was broken mid-shin, as it turned out, but my knee was pointing one way and my foot was pointing another. And
so now you're seeing your body misshapen, really.
Yeah, it was strange, and I kept trying to stand up and use my legs like I always have my whole life, and the bones kind of slipping by each other. I mean, I could feel the pressure, but I couldn't feel pain at that time. It would just, my body wasn't processing it, and so I was dazed. I was dazed. I was a little bit confused. And
how did you sense time at this point? Was it moving fast? Was it slow motion? What?
It was slow motion, almost like. And everything was just disoriented. I was completely disoriented. But I remember looking down and saying out loud, "I'm alive," and seeing my friends, one of them who died on impact, and another who was pinned by the wreckage, and I tried to help him and held his hand. And then a woman who was trapped in her seat, who survived but was horribly burned, screamed, "The plane's on fire."
What do you do when you suddenly hear now that the plane's on fire?
I was still so dazed. I kind of looked to my right and looked through the slats in the seat, and I could see a little flicker of flame. And then it just ignited what it must have been vaporized gas, and hit this poor woman right in the face, and came through the sides of the seat, and caught my leg on fire. And I again tried to think, I got to get out, and I tried to stand up again, and I wasn't processing, my legs weren't working. So, but I rolled to my back and I pulled my knees up one at a time with my arms, and then rolled back to my elbows and knees, and started inching my way out of this plane as it's burning. And they were probably in their late 50s, early 60s, two farmers, Guatemalan farmers, ran around the tree line and ran right to me. And I said, "Ayúdame, help me," in Spanish. And they came to me and pulled me out and dragged me across the ground, which put out the fire on my leg and laid me on the side of the field. And they, those two brave men, went running back into the flames and were able to free two women. One later died of her burns, and the woman who I mentioned earlier. Her daughter had actually been sitting next to her and was in the one seat of the plane where she was able to get out of the plane without injury, but was in shock, and she lost her brother and her dad, and her mom was, when she got out, and they started throwing dirt on them to put out the fire. And
what are you seeing as you look back?
Okay, and I didn't want to watch it. I looked for movement from my friends, the ones I could see, and there wasn't any. And that was a comfort at the time. And these poor women, as they were trying to put out the fire, had nothing to put it out but dirt. And the pain started settling in, and I realized I just lost four of my employees. And the plane exploded at that point, and then the flames started coming across the field, and I couldn't move. And
how far were you from the plane at that point?
I was probably 30 feet.
When it exploded?
Yeah, and it exploded twice. There were two explosions, and this was the first one. And these two, you know, young teenage boys, as I screamed for help, you know, I see that, that was a terrifying moment to see the flames coming across the field, not being able to move. These boys came and pulled me and around the corner and laid me on the side of a road, and I didn't see the plane again. And I kept asking how many got out, and it was, you know, four. So I knew my friends were gone.
In an interview with the Deseret News, you talked about that. You said the first thing that went through my mind was I'm going to die, and the next thing was I'm okay. It felt like it was okay to die. How does one get to that point where such peace accompanies such horrifying reality?
Yeah, I've thought a lot about that. And I think it comes down to covenants. And I think, you know, Heavenly Father gives us covenants for us. He doesn't need them. And I thought since that time that there are measurable things that I knew I was doing right. And I wasn't perfect. And I knew that. But I felt like I had done my best, and I could answer those questions that you receive in a temple recommended review. I could answer them truthfully. Mm-hmm. And I felt, you know, I didn't go through all that in my mind at the time.
You just knew.
But I touched base, and I thought, you know I don't have anything terrible. That's not the moment you want to be thinking, gosh, I wish I would have spoken to my bishop about this, or I wish I would not have said this to my, you know, my spouse or a friend or a, you know, family member. And so I was grateful for that. At the time, I didn't dwell on it because I thought about my family. But afterwards, that was a great comfort to me. I just hope that the next time I die and go through those same emotions, that I can feel the same way. And I think about that a lot.
So that becomes really, if nothing else, sort of a life challenge now to make sure that you're in that same position when your time really does come.
I think Elder Maxwell said it well. The only lasting tragedy is sin. And we have a way to make sure that our souls are healed from that.
That gets corrected.
Yeah, and that gets corrected. And so, you know, life, and I've said this maybe too much, life is a terminal illness. We will all die, whether you die in a field like my friend John Carter, who was such a good man and who I love, and I love his family.
Do you miss him?
I miss him. He was such a good man, and I know his dear family, Lisa and their kids, they're good people. I mean, truly salt of the earth people. Whether you die like John, or you die like my grandpa, who was 92 and was talking, and mid-sentence he passed away. I really think he just probably kept talking, didn't realize he was gone, but died very peacefully. I think 3,000 years from now, all of our lives are going to seem remarkably short, whether it's 33 or 92. Now, I want to make sure that when I go, that I'm ready to go. And I think about that a lot.
And shouldn't, I mean, honestly, we should all be thinking that way.
I had never thought about it. I was 34 at the time. 34-year-old, never was going to die.
Oh, you're invincible.
Yeah, and that changed on a dime. And it hasn't returned to what it was before, and I'm grateful for it. I can see tender mercies all around this thing. I can't really see it in the actual engine failure, but I can see it in the lessons and the tender mercies of the Lord that I've seen in the people's lives and my own life after. So that's a lesson I never want to forget.
You're out there in the field. You've experienced all of this, and now the rescue workers start to take care of all of your injuries. What happened next?
You know, I was sitting on the side of the field, and when you break your legs that bad, once the adrenaline starts to wear off, the pain started settling in, and I thought to myself, this is going to be the most painful day of my life. And it was. It was horribly painful. But what I've recognized now is that pain fades. The memory, even the memory of the pain fades. But what I remember now, and I am so grateful for now, were the moments of kindness. We were there to build a school. We were there to come and help.
You had good in mind. That was your intent, was to do good.
And moments later, we were in desperate need of help. You know, I'll never forget the men who carried me out of the plane, these boys who carried me around the corner when the ambulance came, and they loaded me into the back of this ambulance and 45 minutes over dirt roads with my feet dislocated and broken from my legs and swaying back and forth and grinding bone on bone and every bounce sending shudders of pain through my body. There was a paramedic who let me hold her hand, and I held her hand, and I remember that, and I'm grateful for that, the sympathy and concern from her.
That's such a simple act, but look how powerful it was in your life at that moment.
No act of kindness is ever wasted. And I bet she doesn't even, I'm sure she remembers that day. She probably has no idea how much it meant to me to hold her hand. And it was going into this field hospital in Zacapa, Guatemala, and it was the nurse who handed me her cell phone as they were taking me into surgery and said, call your family. And I called. My wife was at church at the time, and I left a message. They took me into surgery, and, you know, the kindness of the woman who woke me up with a whisper, not wanting to disturb me, but saying, we've got to get you to Guatemala City. These women are dying, the women who are burned. And it was then out onto a helicopter. And
so there again, a gentle kindness in the voice.
Just a tender, sweet woman who didn't want to shake me, but who with urgency said, we've got to move you. It was on that helicopter ride, as I had no pain medication that day, and I was uncomfortable, and my body was bruised and broken, and I'm laying on the stretcher, and there was a sweet man who had probably in his late 50s, who saw I was uncomfortable. And he made his way over through the helicopter and put my head on his lap and just ran his fingers through my hair. I bet he doesn't remember that. I remember it. And it's tender to me because it was a comfort to me. It was coming to Guatemala City and going into the emergency room and into the x-ray room, and they cut off my BYU shirt, which I'm still a little bitter about. I would have taken it off, and then they cut off my garment top, and it was Zuela, a member of the church who's one of the nurses, who said, can I get the elders for you? And I said, yes, please. And she looked at the nurses who were with her, and they just said, go. And she ran out of there and brought back two sweet Guatemalan brethren from the temple.
She ran to the temple.
She ran to the temple, and the brethren who came back, you know, these sweet brethren, I couldn't understand a word they said. I speak Spanish, but with cracked and calloused hands, you know, just sweet men laid their hands on my head and gave me a blessing. And I'm grateful for that. Those are the things I think about and make me emotional. Things that you know, they probably don't remember, but I remember. And I think about it often. I think, how often do we have opportunities and a small kindness? You just never know what it means. And I know how much they mean to me. And I think about that a lot, about what real service is. And we were trying to do something good down there. But it was the gentle, tender kindnesses that for me, I will never forget. It was in after Zuela left the emergency room, I ran down to get the elders. Somebody loaned me a cell phone, and I called home, and I just missed my wife, and then I called her cell phone, and she picked up. And I was so grateful that I got to speak with her first. And I just said, "Brooke, we've been in a plane crash." And she said, "That's not funny." And I said, "No, they're all dead. And my legs are shattered, but I'll be okay." I gave her a few bits of information, told her I loved her, and I'm glad I got to tell her first. And she made the phone calls, and things got into moving up there in the States.
That had to have been hard for her to have to do that.
You know, my wife is an amazing woman. She handled it beautifully. She just went into action, and we had our moments of sorrow, certainly for our friends. And I tell you, there was nothing in the world. One of the great moments of my life was 2 days later when she walked into my hospital room in Guatemala City. I just can't describe it. But she was magnificent under pressure.
When you saw Brooke, was there a conscious feeling of your own eternal bond? What did you think when you saw her?
You know, it was interesting. On the way down on that plane, I did not think of Brooke. But when we landed, that's all I could think of. You know, she's my best friend and the love of my youth and every good thing. And I couldn't wait to talk with her. And I thought about that. I always see that she's my other half. She is, I have faith in that, in marriage covenant and all that. And when I mourned my kids, I mourned what I would miss.
Right.
Them growing, which is the joy of a parent and the things you'd miss. And I know you understand that.
Right.
But I share everything with her. And so when she walked into that hospital room, it was like the sun rising in this horrible experience for me. And she was just so tender and really pragmatic when I got too whiny, and sweet and gentle when I needed it. And she made me get out of my hospital bed, get in a wheelchair, and go to the funeral of my friend. And I did not want to go. And she said, "You have to go." And I'm so glad I did. I mean, those are the things that she pushed me where I needed to be pushed. And she comforted me where I needed to be comforted. And
so everybody rallied around you.
Yeah,
at that
and
moment.
Our ward and our friends and everybody. I came home to hospital bed that was donated by a friend from an old ward, and ramps built by our oldest quorum, and a perfectly clean house from some of my wife's dear friends and my in-laws and others who just rallied around. And there was a lot of really sweet service that was done for us that I'm very grateful for.
So how long were you in Guatemala, and when did you return?
You know, I was stable. They did my surgery Sunday night and put a rod in my leg and put some screws in my ankle and kind of patched me up and put stitches where they need stitches. And by Tuesday or Wednesday, it was Wednesday when they said, "You know, you're stable. We don't think there's any internal bleeding. As soon as you feel like you can withstand, you know, getting on a plane again, and there will be swelling, of course, there's a lot of small tissue damage, but," and I just said, "Let's go." And so
were you afraid at all to get on another airplane?
You know, it was different. I hadn't flown a lot of small planes before. Our plane was a single engine prop plane that crashed, and I really hadn't flown very much. So, in my career, I think I've logged almost 400,000 air miles. And so I've flown a lot. In fact, I worked on an airline turnaround, a big planes, you know, when I was in consulting. So big planes to me weren't the same. And they put me on a plane in first class. It's the only time I really didn't enjoy first class. That flew me home. And I always thought, as long as I can hear the engines working, it'll be fine. And that's what I always think. I always listen for the engine. If the engine noise is stable, it's going to be fine. I haven't gone on any single engine planes since, but you know, I didn't really think about it very much. It was just a totally different experience being on a big plane than a small one. And we got home.
You're listening to Life's Fragile Freefall with guest Dan Lilienquist and host W.A. Christensen. Join us after the break for more of Enduring It Well on the Mormon Channel, sponsored by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. W.A. Christensen, writer, producer, father of four medically fragile children, and host of the Mormon Channel's program, Enduring It Well.
I've always loved the plan of happiness, even as a young boy. It always seemed logical, loving, and, well, right. But when our first son was born with multiple birth defects, the plan took on a whole new meaning. Eventually, all four of our children were born with the same rare muscular dystrophy. We knew the plan in theory, but now it took on a much deeper meaning of hope and trust as we raised the children. It was not uncommon to hear our children say, "We're the luckiest family," or, "I love my life," even as things got progressively harder. What made the difference? Total faith and trust in the great plan of happiness.
Enduring It Well is about individuals and families who have turned tragedy into triumph by living the gospel of Jesus Christ.
Join me regularly on Enduring It Well.
Actual people. Real trials, true victories.
Our guest today is Dan Lilienquist, who survived a plane crash while en route to build a school in Guatemala with Choice Humanitarian. Dan was one of only three who survived. 11, many dear friends of his, did not. Now, Dan, before the break, you described the crash and your return home for your recovery. Tell us a little more about the reunion.
And my son, who was 8 at the time, was so groggy. He came to the garage, and I just hugged him. I think I scared him, and just started sobbing. That was a good moment, and it was. And they redid my study, and that's where my hospital bed was. And my Gracie girl, she was, I think 6 at the time, came down and patted my hand in the night. And it was just one by one, each one of the children I had a different moment with, and had a lot of fun with them, you know, as I recovered and spent time with them. And, you know, it's interesting. People have asked what's changed. And I think what I've tried to do is I've tried to slow down more with my children. And when I'm home, I've tried to be home. And I'm not perfect at it. But knowing how much I missed when I thought I wouldn't have it, missed the time watching them grow, the more I cherish the time I'm with them.
It's safe to say you don't take it for granted.
Yeah, I mean, I feel an urgency to do things. I still travel a lot with legislative things, but I try to be home. I don't have a lot of hobbies, and I'm really enjoying my kids.
So you had these moments one by one of a reunion with each of them. That must have been sweet as well.
It was sweet. It was at the same time working through each one of the family members of my friends who died at the same time, helping them understand what the last moments of their loved one's life was like. That was mixed in. It was a lot of joy and a lot of sorrow. Joy in my family, sorrow. As I felt it was important for them to know how their loved ones died. And everything I could remember, that was mixed in with all of it. The pain of recovery and the emotional pain of there's a certain level of guilt. You know, I was the president of our company. I was the first one on that plane. I didn't think about where I was sitting at the time. I thought, I want some leg room because I want to read a book. And my colleagues and friends rushed to the front of the plane because they wanted a good view. And I've thought a lot about that later. You know, what are the little moments that nudge you one way or the other? And I can't explain it except to say that I want to make my life count for something. And I've worked through feelings of that. I should, you know, why did I get to come home? And they didn't. And these were fine people, good people.
Let's talk for a minute about guilt, because you said in the Deseret News that, quote, I think guilt is a natural part of my survival. You went on to say, I was president of the company and I had four of my employees with me, and I'm the one who came home. Having such a close brush with death and having lost some close friends, life seems like a very short, very fragile journey, end of quote. Have you come to terms with your survival, and how did you reconcile that guilt?
You know, I'm not sure I have to some extent. I mean, I look at that, it still seems surreal. You know, I saw the picture that I was up at my old company, and I saw the pictures of my friends on the wall today, and I miss them. And it still seems surreal, though.
I think there's probably a lot of people out there who may not fully understand how powerful and how real guilt can be. I know after the deaths of both of our children who died of the natural process of their disease, still even to this day, my wife and I will occasionally rack our brains saying, well, did we do enough of this? Did we do enough of that? And your mind tells you, you did all you could do. Don't feel bad. Don't worry about it. And yet, that's a natural emotion that we have, those guilt feelings. And that's why I'm curious to find out from you.
Yeah, well, you know, I've gone through and played it through my mind many, many times. Could I have helped my friend John get out of the plane? Could I have helped him? Could I have helped? What could I have done? Could I have reached around and unlatched the seatbelt for April Jensen? Could I have helped her? I can honestly say at the time, I was so dazed and in pain, I didn't think. I held my friend's hand, but I think, should I have used both hands to try to free him from the wreckage?
And you're saying this to yourself, like, even though you yourself
sure
are quite injured.
Yeah, and you know, should I have even thoughts like, should I have stayed with them? And you know, why did I get to come home? It was hard for me to be at the funeral of my friend and see his daughter pat the casket, 3 years old. It breaks your heart. And what I've just said, and I've talked to their families, and they, you know, they are so gracious and kind, and they just said, all of them, were so glad you survived. And how can you not love such people? And I love them. And I, you know, I think about them often. And when we see them, it's their family
their
to
family.
Me. But I'll say that what I want to do is make my life count and make sure, if in many ways I feel like my life's not my own. And I've got to do as much as I can to say, look, here's what I tried to do. I tried to make the best of it, not only spending time and loving my family, but trying to make a difference in my community and in the church and in everything I do, and to do it well.
Sort of in their memory, if nothing else.
Yeah, I kind of think I owe it to them, and I think maybe all of us owe it to those who have their lives cut short, and to live it to the fullest. And my perspective on that has changed some too, and that is to find opportunities to serve, and that's, you know, that's kind of how I've dealt with it, because I know logically what I was going through at the time, and physically and emotionally. And, you know, my legs were both broken and dislocated, and I know I couldn't stand. I know I couldn't done much, but you wonder.
Oh, yeah.
So I just, you know, I'm enjoying every day, and I'm trying not to forget. And I'm, you know, if there's an upside of having some pain every day, is that it keeps some of that stuff fresh in a good way. Yeah. I mean,
so it's a reminder to you.
Yeah, it's a reminder, yeah. Sure.
Yeah, it's interesting because, again, I go back to my own circumstance, and I think that both my wife and I, separately as well as together as a couple, had to come to that conclusion that, and it wasn't hard to do through the gift of the Holy Ghost. The Comforter does amazing things as you're being comforted. And there was always this soft, sweet, gentle feeling that, in the case of my children, it was their time. And they got that wonderful blessing of being able to return to their Father in heaven. So I think in a great way for me personally, I believe that my Father in heaven allowed me to sort of keep that eternal perspective in their lives, and not to try to second guess what I could have or didn't do or should have done and all of that. So I, at least for me personally, I find that the Comforter was really powerful in helping me understand that.
And I echo that. There have been so many tender, sweet things that have come of this, that, you know, the pain does fade. Even the emotional pain fades.
What message do you have for someone who's suffering with that debilitating emotion of guilt?
Accept the fact that you're not perfect. But that's what an atonement's for. The guilt I have is questions over why me and why not my friends and that kind of guilt. It's a different kind of guilt than maybe that we would make from making, you know, poor choices.
Yeah.
But the healing's the same. Because I think that is the great mystery and power of the atonement.
And it's been how long now?
It's been over 3 years, just 3 years in August. And
not that long ago.
It's not that long ago. It feels like a lifetime in many ways. Yeah. And yet I can see every moment of that experience in my mind. So, you know.
Now, do you also carry images? I mean, I'm assuming that you go through something as traumatic as this. They've got to just be burned into your head. What do you do? First of all, I'm assuming that's true. And if it's true, what do you do with those
images?
Well,
yeah, it's true. I mean, there's, you know, sometimes you find it, I find it hard to explain because people, it's hard for me to understand. It still seems surreal to me. You know, I found out later you have a 1 in 60 million chance of getting on the next plane and that it will crash. And if it crashes, you have a 95% chance of surviving. And so it still seems surreal. But those images are there. I mean, it can't, you know,
so
certainly.
So what do you do when those images come up? I'm assuming that mentally now this it becomes a challenge for you.
You know, it was for a while because I found out what your brain doesn't let you do. And I was so dazed that I almost felt like somebody had taken 200, you know, Polaroid pictures and shuffled them up. And I couldn't sequence what had happened. And it took me a long time. It was after my first legislative session that I started having flashbacks. And not really flashbacks to the plane, but just, you know, really traumatic, you know, dreams and things about planes crashing, several of them. And you know, and I learned later your brain does not let you process things faster than you can handle. Mm. It took me a long time to remember, for example, that I crawled over one of my friends as I got out of the plane. I didn't even remember it.
Mm. That's a tender mercy in and of itself.
Yeah, and I'm grateful for that. I'm grateful for that. I think it's a miraculous thing that your brain does. Now, you know, as I work through it, eventually, you can kind of follow thoughts and kind of piece things together. And now, I've gone through that process. It took a while. But now I can actually speak about it without triggering those images. I mean, they're there, and I don't think I'll ever forget them. But but they're manageable, I guess I would say. I'm grateful for the reminder. Look, I want to make sure the thing I worry about the most and the only real tragedy long term is if I forget about it and I lose my way. And I think about that a lot. My wife worries about that. I think all of us should worry about that because...
And what you're really saying, if I understand you correctly, is you know how you felt at that moment that it was okay to die, and you want to make sure that you're there again when that time comes.
Look, the net present value, and I always think of I'm a money guy, and the net present value of keeping the commandments of God and keeping your covenants with Him are infinite. It's all He has. Everything that we do when we make poor choices, it's irrational when viewed in the eyes of eternity. Again, a great Neil Maxwell quote, sin is irrational when viewed in the eyes of eternity. And candidly, I think we lose our way and become blinded to, and we when we sin, we really act against our own interests. Because Heavenly Father says, I have all that I have is yours. And covenants and promises and keeping the commandments are really a really good investment strategy because all He has is, you know. And so any time we lose our way from that, we are making poor long-term investment decisions, really, with our life. And you see so many people, and the scriptures warn about it, so many people who lose their way and have, you know, to some degree, some measure of success in the eyes of men and lose their way. And I worry about that. I think every one of us should worry about that. The only real tragedy of our life will be to lose our way. And that's the tragedy. I mean, we can get through sorrow. My wife and I lost our first baby. She lived 20 minutes and I held her as she died, and we buried her in Bountiful. We were in law school in Chicago, and we were back from my sister's wedding, and this terrible experience happened. And we look at that now, and there's a sweetness to that experience. And now we're gratitude in many ways for one that's already home. And in some ways, I'm sure you felt that with your children.
Oh, absolutely. Even the term safely dead always comes to my mind, that they're safe. They're no longer under the influence of this fallen world.
Yeah, and so I believe that. And so I just think that one of my favorite sayings is the sun also rises. Wherein it sets, it also rises. And I think ultimately, as we learn and kind of make our way through this life, I'm finding out there's tragedy and loss everywhere,
all around,
and ultimately, really, it's keeping perspective of what the long term value is.
I
hope I have reminders. I mean, I've got some pain. It's not terrible.
Yeah,
it's not anything your children had to deal with or are dealing with, but I'm grateful for it at times. Other times I complain and grumble, but I'm grateful for it because...
That's to be human. Though.
Yeah, that's right. But I want to make sure that I don't find myself down the road waking up to what a bonehead I've been, you know? The urgency for me is that I want to excel in every aspect of my life, whether it be public service, church service, in my home, in my profession. And I feel that urgency. And that's a good thing.
You learned something in that moment.
When President Uchtdorf said, lift where you stand, you lift where you stand. You lift in your home, you lift in your community.
One of the things you said is, I've always known conceptually that I was going to die, but it became a reality to me. And because of that, I feel like I've got nothing to lose. What I feel like I've got to lose is time. That's why I'm not interested in waiting around. So I try and I take on the toughest things. And if you fail, then you fail trying to do important things, trying to do the great things, the things that if you succeed will change things forever. That's a pretty big mandate there.
Yeah. Well, that's how I feel.
You've said that you've had an unshakable urgency since the crash. Explain that.
You know, Steve Jobs passed away yesterday, and there's a great great quote that I learned from him after the crash I wrote down. And that is, if you live your life as if you've got something to lose, I'm paraphrasing him, but he just said, you're going to die.
I actually have that quote here. I was anticipating that because of your story. Yesterday at his death, it was quoted in 2005, following his bout with cancer, Steve Jobs delivered this quote at Stanford University's commencement speech. And this is what he said, quote, "Remembering that I'll be dead soon is the most important tool I've ever encountered to help me make the big choices in life." He said, quote, "Because almost everything, all external expectations, all pride, all fear of embarrassment or failure, these things just fall away in the face of death, leaving only what is truly important." It sounds to me like you had that similar kind of experience that Steve Jobs did.
I had that experience, and he articulated. I found that quote about a year and a half ago, and I thought, he's right. I'm very grateful for what I've got. There's a lot of great things that bring us joy, and when I say us, my wife and my family and I, you know, I think I appreciate them more and in a different way, and in more of the let's live in the moment. But I'm determined to create memories and moments. You always think there's time. You always think there's time. There's time to do this or do that. And for me, I guess I realized there's not. There's not just time. How do we make sure that we're not missing the great moments? He will not leave us comfortless. And that's been a wonderful thing to see in the lives of the families of my friends who've lost their loved ones. And it's slow and it's painful. And I mourn them still, but in a way that I think the pain of that is fading and the good memories and other things are starting to come to the fore. I'm grateful for it in many ways. You know, I wouldn't want to do it again, and certainly wish my friends were here from a selfish perspective and for their families. But I'm grateful for some of the lessons that I've been learning. That the Lord doesn't leave us comfortless, that He can bind up the wounds, that He understands, that He can understand what my friends' families went through.
He heals the brokenhearted.
Yeah, and He heals the brokenhearted, and does so in a way that allows people to stand and say, there's more to me than I thought there was. And that's a good thing. I have been comforted by so many, really the gospel. I'm all in. I believe it, and I try to live it. And in living it, there are just moments of pure joy that come, and that heals it. I'm grateful for that. I am grateful for the gospel of Jesus Christ. When I became converted to the gospel in my teenage years, it was like the sun rising on my life. And I rejoice in it, and I do my best to live it. And it has comforted me in my down times. It has brought me joy in my great times. And I know it to be true. And even during terribly hard and difficult times, there are tender mercies of the Lord all around. And I'm grateful for that. I'm grateful for the comforting hand of the Lord. There's safety in covenants and keeping your covenants, and really the only real safety. And that was a great comfort to me. Because your family matters most. You don't think about anything else. I know we have a loving Heavenly Father who cares about us. I know even in the middle of tragedy that there's comfort that comes. You know, after the crash and through the associated pain, The thing that I remember most were the tender acts of service. And you have no idea what a small kindness will mean to somebody down the road. I don't think the people who gave me such tender service in meaningful ways to me even realized maybe that they were doing it. The atonement of Jesus Christ heals and puts lives back together. What really matters today will also really matter 3,000 years from now. And if we can see through that lens, through the lens of what a long-term perspective is, we can see through and see wisdom even as we're suffering.
You've been listening to Enduring It Well with host W.A. Christensen on the Mormon Channel. We welcome your comments about today's show and other episodes. To share your comments, send an email through the Mormon Channel's Contact Us page. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter. If you or someone you know is facing a difficult trial, find comfort in knowing that this life has purpose and all things shall be for your good. Tune in next time to Enduring It Well to hear how good people with faith face difficult challenges with courage, conviction, and trust in a divine plan of happiness. Enduring It Well, the Mormon Channel's program of hope and peace, presented by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.